I had the pleasure of meeting Hafa and Len in the 1990s when we sat on study section, and the guy who ran the study section kept on putting us next to each other because he thought we'd learn from each other. And I certainly learned a great deal from Haifan. I didn't know anything about flies other than how to swab them. Haifan is one of the leading world's experts on spermatogenesis, stem cells, and flies. But he has done a remarkable number of things over the years. He's called sometimes Mr. Pee-wee. He's had different names associated with his research. At the time he was at Duke, he has since moved to Yale, and he heads a very large and very exciting stem cell center. He's presented at many international meetings. We're very excited to have him in Montreal and at McGill. Thank you for coming, Haifan, and we'll look forward to your talk.
Well, Bernard, thank you very much for your introduction and for your invitation. I'm delighted to have this opportunity to be here because I've long admired Montreal and especially McGill as the mecca of reproductive biology in Canada. And in fact, I think the impact and influence of the reproductive community here reaches far beyond the Canadian border. Here, I'd like to show you a slide. So this is the NIH Reproductive Biology Study Section in 1998. You can see Bernard is here. The godfatherly Bernard is controlling the fate of many reproductive biologists in the States, and with a smile here. And also, we see actually Dan Carson, the energetic Dan Carson is right here, so who will be a speaker today as well. And so I was a new kid on the block. So I'm delighted. This is also a mini reunion for us. And he was at the study section. Somehow I couldn't find your handsome face on this picture. But he was, I think you started in 1998 too. Or somewhere, no. Okay. Or even earlier. See, you can see the Canadian influence here, even to the U.S.'s largest research organization or funding organization. So today I'd like to give you a progress report of a new mechanism that we recently found that's related to stem cells, especially stem cells in the germline. As you probably know, that stem cells are a small number of tissue founder cells that have the ability to produce many differentiated daughter cells and the ability to self-renew. So this self-renewing ability of stem cells have long been attributed to be controlled by a family of genes that we first discovered also in 1998 called the Argonaut PUE gene family. So this gene family is highly conserved during evolution and encodes proteins which are especially conserved in a central PAZ domain. PAZ stands for PUE and its two arabidopsis homologs, Argonaut and Zele, and the C-terminal PUE domain. PAZ domain later on have been shown to bind to small RNAs, whereas PUE domain resembles RNSH. According to the homology, this gene family can be subdivided into Argonaut and PUE subfamilies. As many of you probably know, that Argonaut subfamily proteins have been shown to play essential roles in both the RNAi and the microRNA pathways, whereas the PUE subfamily proteins are better known for their function in stem cell self-renewal and germline maintenance. For example, this slide shows you a Drosophila ovarian unit now with all germ cells labeled in brown. As you can see, the two stem cells here at the tip of the germline by now have undergone many rounds of self-renewing asymmetric divisions to produce this full complement of differentiating germ cells as well as this long string of developing egg chambers. Now, if you knock out the PUE gene in Drosophila, you see the two stem cells will just differentiate into two egg chambers without any self-renewing divisions. Likewise, in mammalian system, PUE genes also play an important role in stem cell self-renewing divisions. So in mice, there are three PIWI genes. We named them MIWI, means mouse PIWI, and the second one, MILI, means MIWI-like. And the third one, we run out of creative juice, we call the MIWI-2. So here I'm using MILI as an example. Here you all know it's a seminiferous tubule of the mouse by now is 2 months old. And the germline stem cells are a small number of cells which are among these spermatogonia, which are saturated in the basal layer of the seminiferous tubule. By now, these stem cells have undergone many rounds of asymmetric or self-renewing divisions to produce 4 complements of germ cells, including a lot of mature sperm. Now, if you knock out the MILI, which is one of the 3 PIWI proteins in the mouse, you see the germline stem cells are there. However, they undergo very little proliferation or differentiation, again illustrating the importance of these genes for stem cell self-renewing divisions. So the question becomes, what's the molecular mechanism mediated by these proteins? And as I've mentioned to you, the argonaut sulfamine proteins are known to be involved in the small RNA pathways in terms of microRNA and the RNAi pathways, and they bind to siRNAs and microRNAs. We wondered whether the PIWI protein bind to RNA too, and if so, do they bind to the known type of small RNAs? To address that question, we decided to immunoco-precipitating PIWI proteins from mammalian extract. But before I go to our experiments, I'd like to briefly review the 2 known small RNA pathways, the RNAi pathway and microRNA pathways. They both started by the processing of double-stranded precursors by Dicer into the mature form of small RNAs. These small RNAs are then loaded into the RISC complex that contains argonaut proteins. Now, in the RNAi pathway, the loading of siRNA leads to the degradation of the messenger RNA, whereas in the microRNA pathway, this loading and binding to the target via incomplete match mostly leads to translational repression. So we wondered whether PIWI proteins are also involved in this process, and if so, whether they bind to small RNAs. To address the question, we prepared the extract from mammalian testicular tissues, and shown here is one of the 3 PIWI proteins in fly called MIWI. We then used anti-MIWI antibody to pull down MIWI from the testicular extracts and to see if any small RNAs are co-precipitated. And as you can see, indeed, in all these 3 fractions, the RNP fractions, monosome, polysome fractions, you see there's abundant population of small RNAs which are associated with MIWI. And the size of these small RNAs, if you pay attention, they are not about 20 nucleotides, as you would expect for siRNAs or microRNAs, but instead they are about 30 nucleotides. Because these small RNAs only interact with PIWI sulfamine proteins, but not argonaut sulfamine proteins, we call them PIWI interacting RNAs, or piRNAs for short. So in the next few minutes, I'm going to spend a bit of time to tell you the salient features of these new populations of RNAs. So first of all, piRNAs exist in extremely complexity. As you can see, we've now cloned over 60,000 different types of piRNAs for mouse testes alone. The number of this is greater than twice the total number of genes in our genome, and hundreds of times greater than the complexity of microRNA. And the second interesting feature is that despite the fact that we've cloned so many different types of piRNAs, most of them appear to be derived, namely transcribed, from a very limited number of loci in the genome. Shown here is a mouse genome with all the chromosomes graphically illustrated here. These loci with triangles indicates the loci where piRNAs are produced, and the size of triangle indicates the number of piRNAs will be produced from this loci. Now let's focus on chromosome 17. There are 2 clusters there that can produce piRNA. If we zoom into this cluster, it looks like this. It's a 90 KD long heterochromatin corresponding to piRNAs. Now individual piRNAs here, I'm coloring them in green as a vertical bar if they are corresponding to 5 primes to the left and 3 primes to the right. I'll color them in red if they're corresponding 5 prime here and 3 prime here. As you can see, these piRNAs, about 1,000 here and almost 2,000 here, they are really in an overlapping fashion from this direction and from that direction. So that immediately led us to propose that these so many different species of pRNAs are actually derived from two divergently transcribed long single-stranded RNA precursors. So we've now cloned the fragments of these precursors, thus proving this hypothesis. So the second interesting feature is that these pRNA sequences correspond to all types of genomic sequences. They correspond to gene coding sequences. Within gene coding sequences, they correspond to protein coding sequences, to introns, as well as to 5' and 3' UTRs. These pRNAs, a lot of them also correspond to intergenic sequences, to repetitive sequences, as well as to transposons. So again, this is very striking for this new population of small RNAs, in contrast to microRNAs, which only correspond to 3' UTR of mature transcripts. So this suggested to us that if these pRNAs have any functions, their function must be very diverse. So we are very excited about this finding because, as you know, that the entire broad field of molecular biology in the past 60 years or so have been focusing its study on the central dogma, which tells us genetic information in DNA is transcribed into messenger RNA, then with the help of several other types of RNAs eventually translated into proteins and then leads to life processes. So several years ago, the discovery of microRNAs and endogenous siRNAs further enriched this dogma by saying that there are two new mechanisms that regulate either the stability or the translation of messenger RNAs. However, if you wanted to be a devil's advocate, this central dogma actually is quite limited because it only talks about 1 to 2% of our genomes. Then how about the rest of our genomes that people often call the junk DNA by convenience? I like to call them terra incognita. So we now found that a lot of these so-called heterochromatin non-coding sequences actually do code for these special genes which can produce a lot of pRNAs. So we are very excited about this. Obviously, we are euphoric in a way because we feel like traditionally we know the old world, which contains about 26,000 genes in our genome. But now, suddenly, there's a new world that we found that contains another type of genes and probably in a way even much more complex. So we are very excited about this finding. And in fact, when the pRNA was first found, it got quite a bit of attention from the field and was selected by the Science magazine as one of the 10 breakthroughs of the years. So this excitement aside, important question still remains, do these pRNAs have any functions? So to address the function of these pRNAs, we decided to go to Drosophila, where the genetics is much more feasible to achieve. So here is the Drosophila genome. Shown here is the X chromosome with telomere here, centromere here, second, third, and a tiny fourth chromosome. We then decided to clone out pRNAs in Drosophila, and we've cloned out over 14,000 pRNAs that are specifically associated with PV protein in Drosophila. And these pRNAs correspond to all types of genomic sequences in fly genomes as well. And in order to study the function of pRNAs, we decided to focus on a particular pRNA that uniquely corresponds to a non-repeat sequence in the subtelomere region of the telomere of the third chromosome. Because that telomeric region is often called the telomere-associated sequences. So for simplicity, I'm going to call this pRNA as TAS pRNA for short here. So the first question we wanted to know is whether this pRNA has any function. And given this pRNA is actually localized in the nucleus and binds to the PV protein, which is also a nuclear protein, and also given that this pRNA corresponds to a non-gene coding sequence, we wondered whether this PV pRNA complex actually binds to the chromatin. That indeed is the case. When we did the chromatin immunoprecipitation analysis with anti-PV antibody, you can see specifically that pRNA corresponding genomic sequence is enriched 400-fold over the non-specific control. That indicates that this particular PV TAS pRNA complex binds to its genomic sequence that matches to the pRNA sequence. So we then wanted to confirm this molecular analysis by cell biology And shown here is the Drosophila polyten chromosome, which really is a beautiful graphic representation of the fly genome. As you can see, when you stain these chromosomes with PV protein indeed is a protein that's associated with many regions of the genome, including the particular sequence that we shown earlier in last slide, that it binds to the pRNA and the genome. So now we know that the PV pRNA complex binds to the pRNA complementary sequences in the genome. We wanted to know, does this kind of binding have any impact on the epigenetic state of the target sequence? To address that question, we first looked into the epigenetic marks of the TAS DNA, namely the pRNA target sequence in the genome. And you can see that so-called typical heterochromatin actually also contains abundant euchromatic marks, such as acetylated form of H3K9 and the methylated form of H3K4. Of course, it also contains heterochromatic marks, such as HP1 and the methylated forms of H3K9. Interestingly, when we remove the PV protein, the euchromatic marks are drastically reduced, whereas the heterochromatic marks are significantly or noticeably increased. So this immediately suggested to us that the binding of the particular PV pRNA complex to the TAS sequence actually promotes the euchromatic feature of that sequence. We then wondered, such an epigenetic mark change actually has a functional consequence in transcriptional activity. And to address that question, we looked into the expression of the TAS pRNA itself, because that pRNA can only be derived from that sequence, because this pRNA uniquely corresponds to that sequence. So we did the RNA protection experiment, and we found out that TAS pRNA indeed is expressed in the wild-type flies, both in the gonads and also in the extragonadal somatic tissues. However, if you remove PV proteins, you see the pRNA expression level is reduced to non-detectable levels. So this suggested to us the binding of the PV pRNA complex to the target sequence indeed is required for the transcriptional activity of that sequence, and we further confirmed these results again by cell biological analysis. So now the question becomes, how do these PV pRNA complexes achieve epigenetic function? To break down these multi-million dollar questions to more manageable ones, we first ask, what kind of proteins does PV interact with to achieve epigenetic regulation? To address this question, we have been taking yeast-2 hybrid and proteomic approaches. Today, I'm going to show you an example of the results from our yeast-2 hybrid screens. We found that actually PV specifically interact with heterochromatin protein 1A or HP1A. The interaction is very specific because, as you can see here, HP1A only interacts with PV but not with its closest homolog called albergin in flies, nor does HP1A interact with three other agonal PV proteins, namely agonal 1, 2, and 3. Likewise, PV only interact with HP1A, but not with HP1B or HP1C. We are very happy with this finding because, as you probably all know, that HP1 is a central player in epigenetics, and it's highly conserved from yeast to human and plants. HP1 is especially associated in heterochromatins and in any heterochromatic sequences. Shown here is the Drosophila polyten chromosome. You see HP1 proteins are highly enriched in a structure called the chromocenter, which is the aggregate structure of central American heterochromatins. The HP1 molecule is also associated with many other euchromatic regions and telomeres. Now, HP1 molecules contain two functional domains. The chromoshadow domain that binds to the methylated form of H3K9 and is responsible for the epigenetic repression that we see, and the chromoshadow domain actually is responsible for interacting with other proteins through the recognition of a motif called the PXV. PXVXL motif that's often present on the surface of the interacting proteins. So we then wanted to know how does HP1 interact with PV. Through a series of deletional and point mutation analyses, we found that actually HP1 molecule interact specifically with the PRVKV motif that's centered around valine 30 in the N-terminal domain of the PV protein. If you mutate this valine at the 30th position into alanine, you completely abolish HP1-PV interaction. If you mutate other valines in other putative motifs, it does not affect interaction. And of course, a double mutant will affect the interaction. We then further collaborate with Pezo's lab to do structural analysis, and we showed by NMR analysis that HP1 molecules indeed directly interact with PV protein. Shown here are the two HP1 molecules' chromo shadow domains, one colored in blue and the other one in green. As you can see, chromo shadow domains from two different HP1 molecules, they form a dimer which create a asymmetric interface, then binds to the PV peptide. I'm only showing the interacting residues here for the ease of visualization. As you can see, the interaction happens mostly at the C-terminal end of the central alpha helix in the chromo shadow domain. Interaction also happens at the beta sheets H and at the extended loop. We are very excited about this finding because, as some of you may know, that a major advancement in epigenetic research in recent years is the implication of small RNA pathways in epigenetic regulation, as mostly done by those beautiful work done in fission yeast. However, despite that progress, the direct molecular interface between a small RNA pathway and that of a genetic canonical epigenetic pathway is not known. And now we found a clear molecular interface between a key component of a small RNA pathway and a central component of the canonical epigenetic pathway. So we then wanted to know whether this PV-HP1 interaction is important for epigenetic regulation, even though we know these two proteins by themselves both are very important for epigenetic regulation. To address that question, we did a series of experiments, and I just want to show you one of the one lines of the evidence here. Here's a fly. When you mutate the PV gene, the flies will be dead. Now, if you introduce into these PV mutant flies a wild-type copy of transgene, that transgene can completely rescue PV's viability. Now, if you mutate in that transgene the valine residue that's required for PV to interact with HP1, then this transgene completely fails to rescue the PV viability, which shows that the PV-HP1 interaction is very important for the function of flies. And we've done further experiments to show that this interaction occurs in cell autonomous manner is very important for the epigenetic programming of these cells. So then the question becomes, how does PV-HP1 interaction achieve such epigenetic regulation? So if you know about, which I believe you all know to some extent, the HP1-mediated epigenetic programming pathway, which can be simply illustrated here. For example, for a sequence in the genome that's going to become heterochromatin, it will somehow first attract histone methyltransferase. And this enzyme will then methylate H3K9, which then will provide a substrate for the binding of HP1, which then leads to epigenetic silencing. However, I've shown you two new observations which are not included or predicted by this pathway. The first line of observation is that PV pRNA complexes actually bind to chromatin. And the second observation is that HP1A actually binds to PV, and in fact, in the absence of the methylated form of H3K9. So these observations suggest that it's possible that PV may act in upstream of this known epigenetic pathway. To address that question, we ask whether PV actually is required for the methylation of H3K9, because if PV indeed is acting upstream, it may be even be upstream of the methylation process. And that indeed is the case. When we did genome-wide ChIP-seq analysis to map at high resolution the methylated form of H3K9 throughout the genome, shown here is only the left arm of the second chromosome here. You see there are many peaks of the methylated form of H3K9. But now in PV mutants, in these boxed regions, the methylation of H3K9 is reduced to background level, which suggests that at least in these regions, PV is required for the methylation of H3K9. So a conclusion we can make so far is that PV somehow acts upstream of HP1A and the methylation of H3K9. If this conclusion is right, it can further predict that HP1A depends on PV to bind to chromatin, and that indeed is the case. When we look into the wild-type flies, again by deep sequencing, you see there are many peaks of HP1A. Again, shown here only is the left arm of second chromosome. But in the PV mutant, the HP1A binding is eliminated to the background level. So a simple explanation we can have here is PV and piRNA form a complex which recognize its corresponding sequence in the genome, and then this complex bring HP1 to the site, which initiate epigenetic programming, and somehow this complex will then further bring histone methyltransferase to the site, which then leads to further establishment of the epigenetic programming program. Now, if this model is correct, it can further predict that PV localization should be independent of HP1A, yet PV localization should be dependent on RNA because it's mediated by piRNAs. And that indeed to be the case. So shown here is actually a Drosophila chromosome set isolated from HP1A protein, now mutant, now stand for HP1A protein, so you don't see any HP1A protein there. But you know the chromosome is there because when you stand this same set of slides with anti-PV antibody, you see PV proteins are all there still on the chromosomes, which indicates that PV localization or binding to the chromatin really is independent of HP1A. However, this binding is RNA sensitive because if you treat this chromatin with RNAs such as RNAs-A, you can largely eliminate the binding of PV. So far I've told you several lines of observations. First, PV localizes to chromatin. Second, PV localization is HP1A independent. Yet HP1A directly binds to PV, and HP1A depends on PV to localize to the chromatin. I've also shown you that the methylation of H3K9 also depends on PV. So how to put all these observations together? So these observations and several other lines of observations that I don't have time to present here today allowed us to propose a PV piRNA guidance hypothesis to illustrate the function of PV proteins and piRNAs when they're in the nucleus. So we propose that PV and piRNA form a complex. This complex will then bind to its complementary sequence in the genome. And this binding in some regions is mediated by piRNA interacting directly with DNA, and in some other regions it's by piRNA interacting with a nascent RNA transcript from that region. And this binding then leads to the recruitment of epigenetic factors such as HP1 to the target site, which then initiate and further elaborate epigenetic programming of the target site. We are very much focused on testing this hypothesis in my lab currently because we think this hypothesis addresses a central question in epigenetic programming. As you probably know that epigenetic field has been focused study on epigenetic factors which modifies the methylation status of DNA or the various form of modification of the histones, which then leads to open versus closed configuration of the chromatin. And we all know that these epigenetic factors always knows how to go to the right place to program the right part of the genome. For example, they bind to here, but not here or here. However, we all know that none of these epigenetic factors themselves actually have any ability to recognize any DNA sequences in a specific fashion. So an important question to me becomes really what's the mechanism that guided these epigenetic factors to the right site in the right type of cells at the right time to achieve their function. So in a way, these are like working class molecules. There must be a mastermind mechanism there to program them. And in the past few years, several lab studies have shown that a few transcriptional factors, can recruit a few epigenetic factors to the promoter regions of several genes, which start to address the question, However, in the grand scale of epigenetic programming, that cannot possibly be counted as a major mechanism. And we are very happy to find that the PV-PRNA pathway, at least in Drosophila, represents a major mechanism that guides epigenetic factors to the right side in the genome for epigenetic programming. And we believe there are other mechanisms exist as well. So now, as a stem cell person, ultimately, I'd like to ask a biological question. Is this a PV-PRNA function related to stem cells? And the answer is yes. Again, we started in flies. This is a fly ovary now with all the germ cells labeled in green. The two stem cells here, I have now again produced these four complements of differentiating germ cells and a long string of egg chambers. Now, if you knock out the PV gene, the two stem cells, as I showed you earlier, become two egg chambers. Now, intriguingly, in these PV mutant flies, if you overexpress a particular PRNA, namely the TAS PRNA I showed you earlier, in 70% of the fly ovaries, you can completely rescue the self-renewing division activity of the stem cells to produce wild-type looking ovaries. So that's a very clear illustration that PRNAs are very important for stem cell self-renewal, at least for this type of PRNAs. So we then also wanted to know whether the PV-PRNA function is related to cancers. So to address the question, we again started in flies. This is the tip of a fly ovary with all the germ cells labeled in green. And there are two germline stem cells here, each contain an organelle that we found earlier and called as a spectrosome. Now, when you overexpress PV protein in this region, you see these spectrosome-containing cells are increased drastically from 2 to up to 15, and with 7 of which is shown in this particular focal section. And these spectrosome-containing cells are actually most likely functional stem cells because they can still undergo asymmetric division to produce a lot of oocytes. Now, in this data shows us that the doses of PV can regulate the size of stem cell population and their mitotic activity. Encouraged by that result, we decided to examine whether overexpression of any PV genes, such as human PV or HIV itself, is correlated to germline cancers, which are known to be related to the malignant proliferation of germline stem cells or their precursors. And we found that, indeed, in seminomas, that's a major form of testicular cancer related to the overproliferation of germline progenitor cells, you see human PV gene is highly elevated in its expression level. In fact, this is the first gene to show such a strong correlation with this particular type of tumor. And this correlation is very specific, not there in the non-stem cell tumors. Encouraged by that result, we further moved into somatic tissue to show whether somatic cancers are also correlated to the overexpression of PV genes. Shown here is a normal patient's gastric mucosa region sectioned through the mucosa neck area and now stained with PV protein in brown. As you can see, PV proteins are expressed in these putative stem or progenitor cells in the mucosa neck region, but not in regular mucosa epithelial cells. Now, if you look into a mild form of gastric malignancy called the atrophic gastritis, you see PV protein become ectopically expressed in all the mucosal epithelial cells. If you look into a similar condition in the small intestine called the intestinal metaplasia, you again see the ectopic expression of PV protein in all the mucosal epithelial cells. Now, if you go back to the gastric region, look into the gastric cancer patients, you see the PV protein become highly and ectopically expressed. In fact, we've quantified the expression level. It almost linearly predicts the progression of this type of malignancy. So encouraged by this result, we further isolated these cancer cells from the patients and turned out these cells can grow robustly in the petri dishes. But as soon as you introduce either antisense RNA or double-stranded RNA that's against the HIV protein, you immediately stop this cancer's growth. So this provides a very strong line of ex vivo evidence suggesting that the overexpression of a PV protein in this type of cancer is not only a correlation, but might be a cause of this type of cancer. So we are actively pursuing this kind of study, and I'd like to actually now summarize what I told you so far. Today I represented to you a new small RNA pathway we call the PRNA pathway, and I forgot to mention that The pioneers were discovered independently by my lab, and soon after that by three or four other labs, namely Greg Hannon's lab at Cold Spring Harbor, Bob Kingston's lab at Harvard, Tom Tuchel's lab at Rockefeller, and Xiaomi's lab in Japan. So now our further work since the discovery of pioneers showed that this represents a major RNA pathway started by the transcription of long single-stranded RNA precursors from often heterochromatic regions in the genome. And then these long precursors will be chopped not by dicer, but likely by the PV proteins themselves into mature pioneers. The PV proteins will then bind to these pioneers to form PV pioneer complexes. And I showed you today that when these complexes are in the genome, in the nucleus, they have very important role in epigenetic regulation, whereas when these complexes in the cytoplasm, that will lead to the regulation of translation and messenger RNA stability. And of course, these pathways have very important functions in germline development, in stem cell self-renewal, and in cancer, as shown by my lab, and also in transposon silencing, as shown by Greg Hannon, Phil Zamo, and several other labs. So I'd like to start by acknowledging these wonderful people in my lab who did a lot of work, so I can do a lot of talking here. Shane Griffner, a former student, and Ergen Brett, a current student, they are responsible for the discovery of pioneers in the mammalian cells. And Han Yin, a former student in the lab, is responsible for discovery of pioneer in Drosophila and for all the bioinformatic analysis I showed you today. And Seth Findley, a postdoc in the lab, is responsible for discovering PV-HP1 interactions. And I don't have time to tell you about other lab members' exciting work, but I just want to acknowledge my collaborators. Peizhou, Lingjiang, a postdoc in Peizhou's lab, collaborated with us on the NMR analysis of PV-HPN interaction. Brent, a student in Sally Elgin's lab, that did the beautiful polysome staining that I showed you in my talk today. DeBosch and Michael Schneider collaborated with us on the deep sequencing, and Linda Ruyanka collaborated with us on seminoma studies. And Xiaoying Liu, a professor at Beijing University, collaborated with us on gastric cancers. Thank you very much for your attention. I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Yeah, quite an amazing story. Please go to the mic and give your names because we are recording it. Questions?
Oftentimes, pyRNA is said to be specific to germline.
Yes.
From your data, like a fly dies in PV knockout.
Exactly.
You show that's the expression in the normal tissues, the gastric glands, and stuff.
Right.
Can you elaborate this current status of understanding?
Sure. So, you know, if you read all the reviews, they all say pyRNA is in the germline, but that really is a partial view of the pioneer's expression and function. In fact, the pioneers are also there in somatic cells, even though the phenotype of PV proteins are only stereotype phenotype. But as I showed you earlier, we now have found the null mutation of PV, which shows somatic phenotype, as you indicated, lethality. So that clearly indicates the somatic function of PV, at least in flies. And in mammalian system, we are doing triple knockout to knock out all the PV proteins to see whether now there's a somatic function. And even if the triple mutant still shows only fertility phenotype, it doesn't mean these proteins don't have function in the genome. Their function in somatic cells might be redundant or complementary to agonal subfamily proteins. And I think I covered that.
Right.
And recently, there's a paper showing that pioneers are found in neuronal cells.
What cells?
In neuronal progenitor cells.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, Hugh Clark McGill. Well, I guess we're all McGill. So I have two questions. First of all, in one of the early slides, I think, did you show us that Mealy and MeeWee interact with different small RNAs?
That's
how
good
I took it.
Actually, did I? I might have taken out the slide last night.
I thought I wrote it down. And
right, so there might be a slide like that. And the answer is that MeWe and MeLe, they do interact with different type of RNAs.
Do we know what the basis of the discrimination is?
By size selection, not by sequence preference. And there is a, as you can imagine, size selection is not perfect. Usually MeLe binds to pi RNAs which are around 26 nucleotides, but it's a normal distribution. And MeWe binds to pi RNAs which are about 31 nucleotides. So there's an overlapping region that they both can bind.
I see. Yeah. And the second question was, I think in the PeeWee knockout, you showed that the pi RNAs are absent. I think that was an RNA's protection.
Right.
So is this an effect on the transcription of the, I guess, the precursor RNA, or is it an effect on the stability of the pi RNAs post-transcriptionally, or do we know?
Right. We think, although we don't have definitive proof yet, that's affecting the transcription, because that pi RNA actually is made from that region, and that's heterochromatin region. We impact on the epigenetic marks and the epigenetic status of that pi RNA encoding region. But of course, we haven't find an effective way to check whether that impact on the degradation pathway as well. How pi RNAs will be degraded, that's still not known.
Yeah. I think I'm next, Sarah. Sorry. No, I'm very rude. Ladies first, please. Go ahead. Okay. Thanks for a really exciting talk. I have a couple of questions. So in talking about the pi RNAs binding to DNA, that would require an event to occur before that, which is the melting of the hybrid DNA.
Right.
So can you talk about regulation of pi RNA access to the DNA? Does it happen only during replication? Does it happen during active transcription?
That's a really good question, and I have no answer to it. I can only speculate.
Okay.
And we obviously are trying to work on that. It's very difficult to imagine that pi RNA can bind to DNA, and especially bind to DNA in heterochromatic region, where DNA is so compact. However, we found out indeed that's the case. If you use RNase, which is an enzyme that digests RNA-DNA hybrid, you only remove PV proteins from the central heterochromatic region. That's most heterochromatic regions of the genome. Now, if you use RNase-3 that digests specifically the double-stranded RNA, you remove PV from other euchromatic regions. So we hypothesize that the pi RNA in some regions are directly interacting with DNA. In some other regions, presumably those regions are more transcriptionally active, actually they interact with the nascent transcript. So it's like a kite held by a person model, then it goes to the site. As to how it binds to DNA, we have no idea. It may be through the Watson-Crick kind of traditional matching, might be through very unconventional way of triple helix. We did some calculation. Immunogenically, it's not very favorable, but experimentally, we really don't know how to approach it effectively. It could be transiently. There are some enzyme there to open up the DNA double-stranded for pi RNA to bind. Then that leads to some transcription, and then eventually the further binding of subsequent steps seal back the chromatin. We have no idea. Yeah.
Okay. And then the second question, I was I guess, a little bit surprised that introducing the pi RNAs in the PeeWee knockout actually rescued your stem cell renewal, because the first part of the story, I guess I was convinced that a lot of what pi RNAs are doing is recruiting PeeWee, so that obviously couldn't happen in those animals or in those flies.
Right.
So
so
what mechanism, by what mechanism is having the pi RNA alone able to rescue the...
Yeah, that's a unique good question. It sounds so self-contradicting. So here's our explanation, and we have evidence for that. PeeWee is required for the pi RNA pathways at two steps. One is biogenesis, and the other one is as a binding partner of pi RNA to fulfill its function, the effective function. So the biogenesis function of PeeWee has been bypassed because we artificially overexpressed. Now, as I mentioned to you earlier, once the pi RNA is expressed, it can also bind to other PeeWee proteins, so which substitute for PeeWee to achieve the effective function. However, that binding is not as effective, therefore we don't see 100% rescue.
Okay, thank you.
Sarah Kimmins. Dan actually asked one of my initial questions. Okay. So we can assume then that H3K9 mm-hmm. methylation is present at regions that are transcribing pi RNAs,
yes.
right? Mm-hmm. So what happens if you look in a cell that you've knocked down something like SUVR, one of the histone-methyltransferases, and disrupted the heterochromatin? Mm-hmm. Do you have a paucity of pi RNAs or
an excess? We are just looking
excess?
Into that as we speak.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a very good question, and the experiments are not very trivial because these are all lethal mutants.
Right.
So, in fact, if you knock down SUVR 309, knock down namely HP1, what's happening is the flies will die at the larval stage. Mm-hmm. So we need to find a stage that's enough for us to collect samples but before necrosis happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we found that stage. And we're doing that.
Although
and, of course, to me, the ultimate entry is back to mammalian system and mm-hmm. how this weather, first of all, this mechanism works in mammalian system.
Well, those big exciting
that
results.
In, yeah.
One more question. Have you actually defined the complex? So when you have the targeting with the histone methyltransferase, mm-hmm. the proteins you told us about, are those the only ones that show up?
We have not defined the complex yet.
So there could be something that's involved in unwinding there? So there could be a helicase or something in there?
It's all possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just have not done that kind of work yet. And it's all, as you can see, it's a completely new field, and we feel like we're like mm-hmm. kids in the sandbox. Every day there are new questions mm-hmm. coming to us. Each one of them is very exciting. We just have to pick and choose, yeah.
Great,
and,
thank
you. Yeah.
Let me take the prerogative of asking a question, too. You didn't talk very much about the biogenesis of the pi RNAs, and yet you said PWE is really critical in that.
Right.
So aren't you pushing the question just one step back? Mm. What controls PWEs in the biogenesis? How does it know where to go, and how does it know what to cut and when to cut it?
Right. So actually, you know, pi RNA expression and PWE expression both have cell type and temporal specificity. And PWE's expression among different homologs, their expression during spermatogenesis is very different. That's all what we know. And somehow people are not very interested, myself included, in studying the transcriptional regulation of PWE expression. Really, it's a very important area, but whenever people think about promoted bashing, especially, you know, that's a kind of exercise I did a lot as a graduate student, a nightmare came back to me, and I just feel like we probably don't need to bash promoters if we can avoid. But with all these emotional reactions involved, the reality is we really need to know that. And especially for pi RNA, we do not even know what kind of RNA polymerase is involved in its transcription. It could be one of the three known ones, but I will not be surprised it could be even the new ones. How can these polymerases be so powerful, go through heterochromatin, to make such a long single-stranded RNA up to 100 kb? No idea. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah. Last question.
Raj Dugavati, you wonderfully showed how these proteins function, but is there anything known what controls these proteins, like, for example, anything from the extracellular signals, or are these proteins completely independent of what happens outside the cells?
Right. Actually, we have quite a bit of work on that, because I started as a niche guy, regulate so-called niche signal regulation of stem cells. So, yes, PWE proteins expression in the germline stem cell, that kind of answers your question, actually, is controlled by the niche signals from the neighboring niche cells or signaling cells. In the stem cells, PWE are expressed at a high level. In the differentiated cells, at a low level.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not a yes or no issue. It's a high and low issue.
Okay, so that means it must involve some kind of signaling pathways. If so, what are the signaling pathways, or do we
there
know
are several pathways. The TGF-beta pathway is very important. E-cadherin.
Dan would be very happy.
Right, and also, PWE itself play a dual role. It's also important in the somatic signaling cells to program a status that's appropriate for signaling. So PWE is also an niche gene itself. We can do that because we can specifically knock down or knock out, in fact, PWE proteins either in signaling cells or in germline stem cells, and to see its effect.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.